My last duty as host is to introduce the moderator, and that is I, Lloydie Nui, who works as a consultant to the museum, and I will be moderating this panel. To my right is Professor Norman Okihiro, and to his right is Professor Greg Robinson, and I will introduce them a little bit fully when they begin their talk. I should say, and I hope the panel will go along with it, that a number of people have asked if it would be impolite to leave because there are so many other sessions they would like to at least hear part of. And I spoke for them without their consent and told them I think they would not be too upset with the coming and going because I think we'll have people join in as well. So I won't say feel free, but if you do wish to attend another session, I don't think it will be okay with the panel up here. I have to keep reminding myself to speak into the microphone. Okay. You know, today you'll be hearing two presentations about two of the lesser known experiences of people of Japanese ancestry during World War II. This is the experience of people in Hawaii and Canada. They, like the Japanese Americans along the West Coast, were what I call wartime civilian casualties, who because they were, quote, perceived threats, unquote, threats to the national security, suffered a loss of freedom and abuses of their civil rights. I think, you know, you will find from the presentations you will be hearing that what a historian by the name of Henry Yu, who's a Canadian, has said that people's experiences are situated in a moment in historical time and a particular place. And I think that will become evident as you hear the differences between what we are more familiar with, the West Coast incarceration of Japanese Americans and the experiences of people in Hawaii and Canada. But before I turn it over to them, I would like to comment on this issue with regard to the Latin American persons of Japanese ancestry. I'm not going to speak about the 200,000 or so plus Latin American Japanese and pre-war Latin America, but I want to focus more specifically on the 2,300 or so who were subjected to forcible detention and deportation to the United States. And it is that group that I'm speaking about and not the entire group. This 2,300, 80% of them came from Peru. So in a way, we're talking about the Peruvian Japanese Americans who were forcibly detained and incarcerated here in the U.S. Now, those who were deported to the U.S., most of them spent their time in Crystal City, Texas. And, you know, some of you, especially those who know the Hawaii experience, may think there's some similarity between this experience and that of Hawaiian Japanese Americans who were forced to leave the island and incarcerated here on what we say is the mainland, which I think people from Hawaii object to. in any case, you know what I mean. So let me begin by saying that before the war, and even several years before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government was engaged in what we call contingency planning and in monitoring persons suspected to be dangerous to the United States. So when World War I or World War II broke out in 1941, a program of arrest and deportation backed by the U.S. government and financed by the U.S. government was instituted. And, excuse me. And as a result of that program, this 2,300 were arrested and deported to the United States. Now, this program of arrest and deportation was somewhat casual and loose. I'll give you an example. One of the people who was arrested was a Peruvian named Arthur Shine Yacabi. And Arthur was not on the list of so-called blocked nationals who were the ones being targeted. But he worked for a man, his employer, who was on the list. But the employer, because he had money, was able to bribe the authorities to take Arthur in his place. And so he was not arrested. In other cases, there were those who were able to evade and hide for several months and up to a year until they were compelled to turn themselves in because their families were being threatened by the authorities. These arrested individuals on their way to the United States had their passports confiscated by U.S. Army and Navy personnel. And since the U.S. State Department had already ordered Latin American consuls not to issue visas, when these so-called detainees were brought into the U.S., they were not only enemy aliens, but also designated as illegal aliens. And it was this status that became the root of their problems after the war ended, although there were other reasons for a number of their problems, but that became the major issue I'm focusing on. When the war ended, Peru was not willing, or was at least reluctant, to have the Japanese Peruvian return to Peru. And so 900 of these Peruvians, and I quote again, quote, voluntarily accepted deportation to Japan. Another 100 eventually made it back to Peru, but they were all Peruvian citizens or married to Peruvian citizens. And then a number 300 decided to stay here in the United States and fight deportation. It was this group, two-thirds of whom were in legal limbo, who were paroled to work at Seabrook in New Jersey. So a lot of these Latin Americans made up the core of the workers there. It wasn't until about 1950, early 1950, with the change in our immigration laws, that they were finally able to apply for legal residency here in the United States. Now, in 1988, with the passage of the Civil Liberties Act, the Latin Americans were not granted redress along with Japanese Americans. And the basis for that was that they had been illegal aliens and so were not eligible. A class action suit was eventually filed in their behalf called Mochizuki versus the United States in 1996. And this was settled, although controversially from the point of view of the Latin American Japanese, because although they were granted a presidential pardon, they were only given $5,000 as long as CLA or civil liberty funds remained. So that was in direct contrast to the $20,000 that Japanese Americans here in the United States received. So that is why this issue still remains. And in fact, I think on July 31st of this month, later this month, a hearing is being held at the Judiciary Committee in which a bill to investigate the plight of Latin American Japanese is going to be considered. At any rate, what I would like to, I think, raise before I finish is that here we have a case, especially here, of Latin American Japanese that begins to raise the issue of whether or not the basis for the government action was really military and national security based or had other reasons for having happened. And one bit of evidence that sort of makes you draw, I think, the conclusion that I have is a quote that comes from a secret document issued by General George C. Marshall on December 18, 1942. And it had to do with the processing of Japanese and Germans being deported to the U.S. And in that secret order, he states, and I quote, and let me read that, "These interned nationals are to be used for exchange with interned American civilian nationals." I think when you see that, you can't help but draw at least a similar conclusion that I have. I say all this partly to remind you that as you hear our two panelists speak, you want to keep in mind that the issue of quote perceived unquote or threats unquote may be somewhat of a bogus issue, and the draconian ways in which we try to operate to secure ourselves or to make ourselves secure are somewhat questionable if that becomes the basis of what we're doing. So while you're listening to our panelists, keep that in mind. I think it makes what we hear not only much more important, but also, I think, more interesting for you to keep tabs on. So I've taken too much time already, so let me introduce our first speaker, and he is to my far right, and that is Professor Greg Robinson, a history professor at the University of Quebec at Montreal. I think many of you may know Greg because he's the author of and I can't even, I'm sorry, I forgot the term. So, by order of the president, FDR and the internment of Japanese Americans. But I think for other people, Greg Robinson may be better known, along with Eric Muller, because of their challenge of Michel Malkin, who I call a right-wing ideologue who I believe not only is attempting to rewrite, but distort the history of the Japanese-American internment. But they have done a successful job in blunting her attempt to do this, and I think he may be better known, especially on the internet, for that basis. But he is also known, especially, I think, in the Bay Area, because he writes a column called The Great Unknown and the Unknown Great, in which he shows his ability to, I think, be a creative and, you know, untiring researcher of the Japanese-American experience, in which he has profound so-called, what we call the great unknown, such as people like Hugh Macbeth, a black lawyer. And, you know, the things he has to say today about Hawaii are just a small portion of what he has to share if you ever have a chance to talk with Greg. So let me allow Greg to take over.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, everybody, this morning. Thank you for Lloyd for that introduction and putting this, what I'm going to talk about, in context. What I'm going to talk about today is Japanese Americans and martial law in Hawaii during World War II. Now, most of us, when we think about Hawaii and Japanese Americans, think about the fact that there was no mass roundup and confinement of Japanese Americans in Hawaii during World War II, which is something that leads us to think about Executive Order 9066 and what could have been done and such. And that's very valid. And in By Order of the President, I talk about some of the reasons that Franklin Roosevelt was frustrated in his quest to order mass internment of Japanese Americans in Hawaii. But I wanted to talk today about some of the price of that success for Japanese Americans in terms of the military control in Hawaii. Because wartime army rule in the territory of Hawaii represents a unique case in modern U.S. history where an elected civilian government was overthrown by a military government, by the equivalent of a pronunciamento in Latin American terms, and replaced by an army regime exercising unchecked power. Despite repeated promises to restore democratic rule in Hawaii, military governors held power for 3 years. Long after any threat of Japanese invasion from Tokyo had passed. Military rule was marked by stringent and often arbitrary regulations. Newspapers were rigidly censored, and criticism of military officials or the government was forbidden. At least partly in consultation with haole, that is to say white elites, strikes were banned and labor was minutely regulated. Throughout the war, Japanese Americans in Hawaii were the targets symbolically, or the proxies in the larger struggle for the constitutional rights of all civilians of all groups against prolonged arbitrary government. While military governors did resist mass confinement of Japanese American populations in Hawaii, they justified wholesale denial of democratic rights to the entire population on racist grounds, that if they restored civilian government, local Japanese would be given equal rights, and local Japanese jurors, teachers, and elected officials could not be trusted. So the discrimination against Japanese Americans in Hawaii, as I'll show, affected the rights and liberties of the entire population, particularly in the area of military tribunals, which replaced civilian courts. Well, we know on the morning of December 7, 1941, Japanese naval and air forces executed a mass bombing raid on Pearl Harbor and on the surrounding installations. Actually, the existing fears of Japanese Americans played an important role in that attack and its success because Army Commander General Short had ordered all airplanes at Hickam Field bunched to protect them from sabotage by local Japanese, in spite of the fact that there was no evidence of any threat to those planes. And as a result, they were being bunched together. They were sitting ducks for aerial bombardment. And so they were all the defense planes at Pearl Harbor were particularly quickly put out of operation. Almost as soon as the Japanese bombing occurred, Hawaii Governor Poindexter invoked the provisions of the Hawaii Defense Act to put the islands on a war footing. This act had been enacted by the territorial legislature during fall 1941 with the support of the Army and the Navy to give broad powers to the Hawaii governor in case of war, consistent with minimum safeguards for civil rights and constitutional liberties. However, the same day, General Short visited Governor Poindexter and warned of the urgent menace of sabotage by local Japanese, again, in spite of the fact that none had occurred and that he'd just been caught short at the Air Force base because of it. Short insisted that unless the governor granted full powers to the army, he would not be responsible for guaranteeing Hawaii's safety, and then he threatened to take power unilaterally if the government did not exceed power. Short pressured Poindexter to sign a special martial law proclamation that he produced, prepared by the Army Provost Marshal General's office, that the governor had never seen. It stated that, quote, During the emergency and until danger of invasion is removed, quote, the military commander would not only hold all powers of the governor, but also all powers exercised by the judiciary and by employees of the territory, that is to say, the Assembly of Hawaii. General Short promised that once the immediate crisis was over, civilian authority could be returned rapidly. According to Poindexter, he said a reasonably short time, maybe a few weeks. Poindexter, unable to reach Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, who had nominal authority over Hawaii as a territory, and assured by General Short of President Roosevelt's agreement, decided to sign the proclamation, whereupon President Roosevelt later said that he agreed with the invoking of martial law and the suspension of habeas corpus. General Short, however, immediately declared himself military governor of Hawaii and placed the entire territory under his authority. With these powers in hand, the army immediately arrested over 1,000 Issei and Nisei and held them without charge at a camp at the Sand Island Naval Base. They were later moved, many of them, to a camp at Hanauliuli, which is one of the internment centers in Hawaii. On December 17th, 10 days after the outbreak of war, a new commander, General Delos Emmons, arrived in Hawaii and assumed the post of military governor. Under Emmons, martial law continued in force. The legislature was prorogued, that is, put out of business, and the U.S. Constitution was deemed suspended. Military authorities issued a series of 181 general orders over the next weeks under the authority of Colonel, later General Thomas Green of the Army Provost Marshal General's Office. These orders overturned existing territorial law and regulated all aspects of civilian life, including curfews, wages and prices, supplies of vegetables and other consumer goods, rationing of gasoline, and censorship of mail. The regulations were generally applied in a race-neutral fashion, but it was widely understood that they existed primarily in order to control Japanese Americans. For instance, and some measures, in fact, particularly targeted the Japanese population. For instance, all Japanese schools were ordered shuttered, and eventually they were sold off. The two chief Japanese language newspapers, the Hawaii Hochi and the Nippu Jiji, were closed for a period of 4 weeks and afterwards rigidly censored. Entry to the area of Pearl Harbor called the West Lock, where there were a number of Japanese-owned farms, was closed, and farmers who lived in the vicinity were forced to relocate their residences, although they were permitted to go back and farm their farms during daylight hours only. 1,500 residents of Japanese ancestry were ordered out of Honolulu's Iwilai district overnight. Local Japanese in Hawaii continued to face a mixture of support and hostility. Various non-Japanese Hawaiians, from U.S. Attorney Angus Taylor to University of Hawaii Professor Albert Horlings, all warned that local Japanese were massively disloyal, although their charges were rebutted by official sources, and one prestigious businessman, John Balch, put together various manifestos calling for local Japanese to be confined. On the other hand, an interracial race relations group headed by YMCA officer Shigeo Yoshida and others organized patriotic campaigns and pointed to the supportive activities of local Japanese after Pearl Harbor as indeed their military service in the Territorial Guard. In the days following his arrival, General Emmons ordered the Nisei armed, using scarce munitions at hand, and mobilized to maintain public safety and protect military bases in Hawaii. However, despite the good conduct of the Nisei in the Territorial Guard, pressure arose both on Hawaii itself and on the mainland for disarming Japanese Americans. And on January 21st, 1942, General Emmons ordered the 317 Nisei serving in the Territorial Guard discharged without warning. Meanwhile, the regular Army battalions, the 298th and 299th, were confined to quarters and eventually sent off for training to Camp McCoy in Wisconsin, where they would be far from the Pacific Theater. That's the origin of the 100th and later the 100th 442nd. So historians of Japanese Americans in Hawaii have often told the inspiring story of how the dismissed Territorial Guard volunteers formed the Varsity Victory Volunteers, a labor group, and through their patriotic service, they were able to persuade first General Emmons and later Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy to enlist Japanese Americans in the army and to resist President Roosevelt's pressure for mass confinement of Japanese Americans. General Emmons deserves credit for his cool balancing of the needs for labor and materials and the proper use of Japanese American manpower against fears for security. However, the fact that Japanese Americans remained at large also gave the Army in Hawaii a pretext, once they were granted absolute power, to maintain absolute rule and to keep from surrendering any real authority. The most recalcitrant figure, Colonel Green, who was the one who drew up the martial law proclamation and created an organizational plan for Hawaii that left it with the status of a conquered province, put through numerous military orders using the threat of Japanese Americans as a pretext. He confiscated relief funds granted by Congress for Hawaii and used the proceeds to hire civilian employees to evade local government officials and to ignore the machinery of civilian governments. From the outset, a prominent feature of the military government that General Green created was the imposition of military tribunals erected under General Order 4. These things were not invented in Guantanamo, folks. Although civilian courts were permitted to reopen a week after the attacks and were given civil trials to handle, they were restricted from handling any criminal cases. All criminal cases were tried by a network of military commissions and provost courts established by the military governor's office, allegedly based on the uniform model of military courts-martial. In fact, these military tribunals, which were presided over by armed officers generally untrained in law, were classic examples of drumhead justice, with no rules of evidence, no presumption of innocence, and no constitutional safeguards for fair trials. Juries were forbidden, and lawyers were discouraged or even barred. Furthermore, the Army's suspension of habeas corpus in Hawaii meant that civilians could be held indefinitely without charge. The tribunals frequently issued severe sentences, including fines and imprisonment, for trivial offenses, and the system contained no machinery for appeals. So seldom, in fact, did the tribunals issue acquittals that defendants often chose to plead guilty even when they were innocent of the charges in order not to get harsher sentences. Of the 22,480 trials conducted by the Provost Court in Honolulu during 1942 and 1943, 99% ended in convictions. One Army judge who heard 819 cases where defendants pleaded not guilty issued convictions in all 819. The case of Sanji Abe furnishes an especially clear illustration of the embattled positions of Japanese Americans under the regime. Sanji Abe was a lawyer and a World War I veteran who was a former Honolulu policeman. And before the war, he was elected to the Senate in Hawaii. He was the first Nisei member and the only Nisei member of the Hawaiian Senate. Despite, or rather, because of his position, Abe seems to have been closely watched by the military authorities once war began. On August 2, 1942, he was arrested and charged with possession of a Japanese flag. Abe pointed out that he had never bought or flown any Japanese flag. In fact, the flag had been discovered in a warehouse for a theater, which he was a part owner of, where it had either been stored as a prop or the Army had planted it themselves. He also pointed out that the military orders making possession of Japanese flags a crime were not issued until August 8th, 6 days after his arrest. Army officials were thus forced to release him on August 19th, but even after he publicly burned the offending flag and ceased to fly any others, he remained under suspicion, and 1 month later, in September, Colonel Green had Abe rearrested, this time without charge, and placed in custodial detention, where he remained for 19 months. In the meantime, by the way, all of the Nisei members of the territorial legislature were pressured into resigning their posts and were not running for re-election. So as a result, by the time the Hawaii legislature was finally permitted to meet in the beginning of 1943, none of the 10 pre-war Nisei members had their seats. In August 1942, a new territorial governor, Federal Judge Ingram Steinbeck, was appointed, although his power was largely nullified under the military government. He in turn named J. Garner Anthony as his attorney general. Anthony, a wealthy member of a local elite law firm, had boldly published an article in the California Law Review during spring 1942, arguing that martial law was unconstitutional. As the menace of invasion by Tokyo strongly receded following the Battle of Midway and the destruction of the Japanese fleet, Steinbeck and Anthony grew increasingly impatient over army control and attempted to negotiate a return to civilian authority. However, they were able to make no headway with Green and Emmons. Green had already insisted to McCloy that if regular criminal courts reopened, the 100 U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry who were being held on Sand Island would be able to file habeas corpus petitions for their release. In any case, he noted, military tribunals could assure better justice. Navy Secretary Frank Knox, backed by Admiral Nimitz and Admiral King, commanders of the Navy's Pacific Fleet, agreed that any relaxation in martial law would be perilous because of the danger posed by Japanese Americans in Hawaii and by, they said, the large number of unquestionably pro-Japanese who are still at large on Oahu. Rebuffed by the military, in October 1942, Steinbeck made a unilateral proclamation restoring civilian rule and turned to Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes to help them. Ickes, who had been privately outraged by the unjust treatment of Japanese Americans on the mainland and by Executive Order 9066, immediately appointed his assistant, Interior Undersecretary Abe Fortas, the future Supreme Court Justice, to hold a series of conferences with Green and with Justice Department officials. Initially, an agreement was reached. Fortas proposed that martial law be relaxed and civilian courts resume jurisdiction over all criminal trials except for matters involving members of the armed forces or those people employed by the military governor, which the military tribunals could continue to hear. The army delegates objected, however, that Japanese Americans would be called as jurors in any civilian trial system, and there was great risk that racial hatreds or disloyalties would threaten impartial justice. In other words, Japanese Americans couldn't be trusted, so you couldn't have civilian trials. To calm such fears, Fortas agreed to grant the military governor authority to exempt any persons or class of persons from jury service. However, as soon as Green signed the agreement, he published a general order which interpreted his order to forbid federal courts from challenging the military government, the war effort, or national security. Similarly, Hawaiian courts were barred from trying any criminal cases involving vagrancy, prostitution, liquor control, or assault and battery against law enforcement officers, which meant that there was little change in practice. And again, that's when Green had Sanji Abe arrested. Emmons agreed that the civilian governor must remain subordinate to the military and that he himself must be the one to determine what powers to return to civilian control. He made clear that the presence of so many Japanese American citizens and aliens, I quote, some disloyal and others of doubtful loyalty, quote, made security an urgent consideration. Ickes and Attorney General Francis Biddle then began a new round of conferences with Steinbeck and with the War Department in December of 1942. However, both Assistant Secretary of War McCloy and Secretary of War Henry Stimson believed that in the fortress of Hawaii, the local commander must have maximum authority, and they repeated the official line from Green that martial law in Hawaii was popular with all except the politicians. Well, of course, martial law was popular with everybody in the press, which was censored and had no way to object. Although all the parties had hoped to shield President Roosevelt from the debate, given the vast wartime burdens on him, the two sides reached a deadlock and Biddle appealed to him to press the military. FDR agreed that while, as he said, while Hawaii will not, in all probability, be attacked again, the eyes of the country are and will be on Hawaii and in all conditions therein. So Roosevelt told Biddle that he supported removal of Green and rotation of officers. Stimson, however, responded that if FDR wanted Hawaii defended by the army, he must give them proper authority, or else he could let Ickes defend the territory. In January 1943, Ickes and Stimson finally reached a compromise for a gradual restoration of authority to Hawaii's civilian government, but only, they said, when and as the military situation permits and subject to reversal at any time. Roosevelt agreed that this formula meets the present needs, and in accordance with the deal, on February 8, 1943, General Emmons issued a decree returning authority over certain governmental functions to the territorial government. However, the Army insisted on retaining emergency powers, including censorship, curfew enforcement, and control of alien populations, including Japanese Americans, as well as regulation of labor and control of prostitution. Again, the military was not shy about playing the race card in its reasons for continuing martial law and its defense of its policies. As one friendly observer wrote in the Christian Science Monitor about provost courts and military tribunals, it is generally assumed that if the Japanese population in Hawaii were less numerous, the military authorities would be much more willing to relinquish their control over civilian affairs. Thorough policing and selective detention of the Japanese are regarded as the most effective means of handling this difficult problem. The facts that there have been no interracial disturbances of consequence and that the Japanese have been well behaved are seen as evidence that the Army's methods are producing the most satisfactory results. So it remained this way for 18 more months, despite repeated attempts by Steinbeck and Garner Anthony. It was really a series of court cases, however, that affected martial law and brought about an end to military tribunals. None of these cases were brought by Japanese Americans who were too frightened and too subject to pressure both inside and outside the community to lie low and not do anything that could be perceived as disloyal. But they were the proxies. They were the main source, the main targets in all of these cases. The first legal challenge was that of Dr. Hans Zimmermann, a naturalized citizen and U.S. Army veteran of German ancestry who was arrested after Pearl Harbor in February 1942 when he was, I won't talk too long about this, when he was scheduled to be sent to the mainland. His wife submitted a petition on his behalf. A federal judge in Hawaii, Delbert Metzger, said that he agreed that the habeas corpus petition should be heard, but that he was acting under duress and he felt constrained not to do anything. Following Metzger's ruling, the ACLU obtained a writ on the mainland, whereupon the Army shipped Zimmermann back to Hawaii. Zimmermann's lawyers then appealed Metzger's original denial of habeas corpus to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The Army then called on Earl Warren, the Attorney General of California, who had been a chief mover and shaker in Executive Order 9066, to defend the Army's action. Warren submitted a brief praising DeWitt's removal orders and as a shining example of martial law and saying that he welcomed further martial law in California, that the Army rule was the way to go about. This actually became an issue in the 1942 gubernatorial election in California. Earl Warren, because of his defense of the military, won the governorship. Eventually, in March 1943, Zimmermann was released, barred from Hawaii, and sent off to be deposited in San Francisco to keep his challenge from being heard. The next challenge came from two other German Americans, Edwin Seifert and Walter Glockner, who were also arrested after Pearl Harbor. When they submitted habeas corpus petitions to Judge Metzger after partial civilian rule was restored, in August 1943, Judge Metzger ordered Emmons' successor, Lieutenant General Robert C. Richardson, Jr., to appear before him and produce the two prisoners. When Richardson refused, Metzger fined him $5,000 and cited him for contempt. Richardson responded with General Order 31, which forbade any court in Hawaii from receiving any habeas corpus petitions and threatened Judge Metzger, if he did not abandon all proceedings, with punishment for up to 5 years at hard labor. Metzger refused to withdraw his ruling, and a standoff ensued. Eventually, they reached the Justice Department reached a compromise. The two prisoners were brought to the mainland out of the judge's jurisdiction and freed, thus mooting their case. General Richardson withdrew his orders, and President Roosevelt offered him an unconditional pardon, thus wiping out his contempt citation and his fine. So although the cases of Zimmerman, Seifert, and Glockner had focused some public attention on military government in Hawaii, particularly the Chicago Tribune, which attributed to New Deal totalitarianism, the military tribunals had continued operating through the months of 1943 and into 1944. Eventually, however, a major challenge came in the person of Lloyd Duncan. On February 24, 1944, Duncan, a Hakujin civilian working for the Navy, was arrested for assaulting two Marine sentries at the gate of the Pearl Harbor Naval Base. Brought before the Provost Marshal's court, he was convicted by the military tribunal and sentenced to 6 months in prison. Duncan then challenged the authority of the military tribunals to try him, and Garner Anthony, the Attorney General, agreed to represent him. In 1944, March, Duncan submitted a habeas corpus petition before Judge Metzger. General Richardson and Admiral Nimitz, the Pacific Coast commander of the Navy, responded with sworn affidavits opposing the issuance of a writ. They insisted without further explanation that Hawaii was still in imminent danger of Japanese invasion, and that martial law and suspension of habeas corpus were essential to the war effort. To further rally support, they trotted out the peril of Japanese Americans, stating that the presence of 124,000 U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry, 67,000 of whom were dual citizens with Japan, was an immediate menace. They said, a number of these persons are known to be loyal to Japan and are thus dangerous to the United States. A number are interned. However, despite the pleas of the government, Metzger issued a writ and set the matter for hearing. The hearing opened on April 5, 1944, barely a week after the Supreme Court agreed to hear the Korematsu case, by the way. As with the Korematsu case, the Justice Department was given the task of preparing the government briefs, although its staffers had grave doubts about the constitutionality of martial law. Edward Ennis, who had been an opponent of Executive Order 9066, was given the case. He had the difficult task of showing a state of immediate peril to the war effort sufficient to justify martial law and military tribunals. Although he brought Richardson and Nimitz to the stand to present Hawaii as vulnerable to invasion, under close cross-examination by Garner Anthony, both commanders were forced to admit that any sizable Japanese invasion was very improbable, with the Japanese fleet having been destroyed. Meanwhile, Anthony introduced a magazine article by Fleet Admiral Bull Halsey stating that the Japanese fleet had been put out of operation. So given the weakness of the invasion threats, the War Department and the Justice Department agreed to make the Japanese-American presence in Hawaii the chief excuse for martial law. They argued that the loyalties of Japanese-Americans could not be relied on or determined on racial grounds, irrespective of any time factors, the very argument that they had been forced to abandon in the Hirabayashi and the Korematsu cases. It was ironic that Edward Ennis should be charged with putting forward such a position, since he had struggled unsuccessfully to expose the duplicity of the War Department and the fraudulent nature of General DeWitt's final report in the process of making the government's brief in Korematsu. As ironically, in connection with this line of argument, Ennis focused on the alleged dual nationality of the Nisei, the old nativist canard about dual citizenship, as a factor showing disloyalty and placing Hawaii in direct peril. And in fact, he cited the Hirabayashi opinion of the Supreme Court as authority that the dual nationality of Japanese Americans left them a threat. In the course of his argument, he introduced figures on the population of the territory broken down by race to demonstrate the preponderance of Japanese Americans, and then called a pair of witnesses to testify on the dual nationality of the Nisei. One was Lieutenant Andrew S. Wong, a Chinese-American intelligence officer who had worked for the Census Bureau, and one was a Nisei lawyer in Hawaii, Robert Murakami. Ennis climaxed this line of questioning by calling General Richardson, who testified that the nature of Hawaii's population and the presence of Japanese Americans was an essential factor in, he said, appraising the possibility of attack and invasion. And here I'm quoting the general in his testimony. It is absolutely necessary that the military commander in this area have some means at his disposal for controlling the movements and activities of people who he suspects may be potentially disloyal. Of course, my remarks do not apply to the entire Japanese population, but it would be naive to assume that in a population of 160,000 that we did not find a group of potentially disloyal Japanese. There are the aliens, pure and simple. There are the Japanese who were born here and are American citizens. There are other Japanese who have been expatriated, and there are those who have been born here but registered by their parents in the Japanese consulate, and upon whom the Japanese government professes to exercise a certain degree of loyalty and allegiance. So the Army, in substance, was saying that the existence of Japanese Americans in and of itself made civilian rule impossible. Anthony argued that the entire argument about Japanese Americans was completely irrelevant, but felt obliged to respond. After cross-examining Murakami on the difficulties that pre-war Japanese Americans had in expatriating, he then called Dr. Shunzo Sakanishi, a rare University of Hawaii professor of Japanese ancestry, to testify on the efforts of local Nisei to facilitate expatriation, including the petition signed by 50,000 Nisei in Hawaii during 1941, requesting assistance from the U.S. State Department in helping them get rid of their Japanese nationality. He then countered what he called Ennis's innuendo against the loyalty of Japanese Americans by introducing into evidence a magazine article published by General Richardson, Hawaii Fortress of the Pacific, in which the general stated that any Japanese Americans who were dangerous or potentially dangerous had already been interned, and that those who had remained had on innumerable occasions, he said, proven their loyalty to the U.S. Well, on April 13, 1944, Metzger ruled in favor of Duncan, and he found that habeas corpus had been restored with the reinstatement of civilian government in March 1943, and thus the military court that had tried Duncan had acted illegally. Shortly thereafter, a guy named Harry White, who had been convicted of embezzlement in 1942 by a military court, then brought his own habeas corpus case. So the military government then pursued an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Meanwhile, American victories in the Solomon and Mariana Islands and the push on the Philippines eliminated any remaining conceivable threat to Hawaii from Tokyo. Thus, under pressure, the Army began to abandon its insistence on special powers. In mid-July 1944, when President Roosevelt visited Hawaii, Richardson agreed to abolish martial law, at least in name, but asked for a presidential decree that would grant him special emergency powers, especially powers to control aliens and citizens of Japanese ancestry. It was not until October 1944, 2 weeks before the presidential election, that President Roosevelt signed an executive order officially ending martial law and dissolving the military tribunals. However, the Duncan case and the White case went on. And during July 1944, the case was heard before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Justice Department repeated again the argument that Japanese Americans posed a sufficient threat to national security, that trial by jury was impossible in Hawaii. In November, the appellate court agreed with the government and reinstated the sentences of Duncan and White. The court found that martial law and military tribunals had been legally imposed and that civilian courts, quote, had been disabled from functioning both in 1942 and 1944. Well, of course it had been disabled by functioning because the military government had disabled it. The court agreed, however, that martial law was necessary to enforce military orders and to control Japanese Americans who could be expected to be disloyal on racial grounds. And here again, I'm quoting the Court of Appeals decision. Governmental and military problems alike were complicated by the presence in the territory of tens of thousands of citizens of Japanese ancestry, besides large numbers of aliens of the same race. Obviously, the presence of so many inhabitants of doubtful loyalty posed a continuing threat to the public security. Among these people, the personnel of clandestine landing parties might mingle freely without detection. Thus was afforded ideal cover for the activities of the saboteur and the spy. To function in criminal matters, the civilian courts must assemble juries, and citizens of Japanese extraction could not lawfully be excluded from jury panels on the score of race, even in offenses involving the military security of the territory. So the Court of Appeals, again, was agreeing with the Army, even after Korematsu, even after Endo was argued, that Japanese Americans simply could not be trusted, and that nobody could be free because Japanese Americans might serve on juries. And so the case went to the Supreme Court. And one of the things that's always, that's been quite surprising to me in late years as I've been looking more and more into this, is that constitutional lawyers have not really looked at this. Because at the time, many observers thought that this is the first case where the Army can question and the court can question the Korematsu case. So it was not until December 1945 that the Supreme Court heard the appeal in Duncan and White. The fourth anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack, in fact, December 7, 1945. By that time, of course, the war was over. President Roosevelt had died, and there was no longer a wartime climate of hysteria over national security. On February 25, 1946, the Supreme Court found for Duncan. By a 6-2 margin, they struck down the convictions of Lloyd Duncan and Harry White. The majority opinion was written by Hugo Black, the author of the Korematsu opinion. However, it resembled much more the court's opinion in Endo. As with the case of Mitsui Endo, the court upheld an application for a writ of habeas corpus on narrow grounds and struck down the government's detention of a conceitedly loyal American. In Duncan, the court ruled not that martial law was illegal, but that the Organic Act of Hawaii had not contemplated the supplanting of all civilian laws by martial law and the convening of military tribunals, and that Congress had not expressly authorized such action. However, Black ended his opinion with an essay on liberty that denounced the government's authoritarian rule. He said, "Our system of government clearly is the antithesis of total military rule, and the founders of this country are not likely to have contemplated complete military dominance within the limits of a territory made part of this country and not recently taken from an enemy. They were opposed to government that placed in the hands of one man the power to make, interpret, and enforce the laws." An even stronger statement on the military tribunals was offered by Justice Frank Murphy, who had issued a blistering dissent in Korematsu. In particular, Murphy savaged the government's contention that military tribunals that denied procedural rights to all citizens were essential to avert the menace to security posed by the presence of ethnic Japanese jurors. And again, I'm quoting Murphy. "There was no security reason for excluding Japanese Americans from juries, even making the false assumption that it was impossible to separate the loyal from the disloyal. And even if there were problems arising from the use of racially mixed juries, elimination of all jury trials was hardly a reasonable or sensible answer to these problems. Especially deplorable, however, is this use of the iniquitous doctrine of racism to justify the imposition of military trials." So by the time of the Duncan ruling, there were only a handful of prisoners convicted by the military courts and sentenced to prison terms that were remaining in Hawaii, and they were freed by the court's decision. However, Yale University professor Eugene Rostow, who had scored the removal of Japanese Americans as, quote, our worst wartime mistake, and had called the Korematsu case a disaster, complained that the court had not explicitly overturned Korematsu, even though the Duncan decision represented a full repudiation of its logic. Either because the war was over by the time Duncan was decided, or because the Supreme Court ducked the larger issues of mass confinement and military rule, the Duncan ruling has attracted very little attention from scholars of civil liberties, historians of constitutional law, and most of all by Japanese Americans, who have continued to see Hawaii as being an oasis of equal rights and tolerance during World War II. For this reason, it's important for us, not just as historians, but as citizens, to look at the history of martial law in Hawaii and its connection with Japanese Americans, especially now that another president has created a system of military tribunals to override constitutional rights and hold Americans confined. The establishment of martial law in wartime Hawaii, we have to realize, both in its durability and its broad public support. There was no opposition from newspapers. There was no opposition from local officials. For a long time, there was no opposition from the Hawaii Bar Association. and there were many people, such as Earl Warren on the mainland, who supported it. This suggests that military government is not incompatible with American institutions, and that especially in a time of peril, people are always ready to look to military solutions for constitutional problems. This raises especially disturbing questions for now about how to resist or roll back encroachments on democratic rights by military authorities and their civilian heads in the name of national security, even when, as in the case of Hawaii, it becomes clear that there's no longer any conceivable military purpose for them. So with that, I leave you, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Professor Robinson. As I sit here and listen to your presentation, I can't help but begin to see parallels to what is happening in the United States today. And maybe we can get to this in the question and answer period. But for now, let me introduce our next speaker. To my immediate right, Professor Norman Okihiro, who is a professor and currently chairman of the Sociology and Anthropology Department at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He comes a long ways to join us today. Professor Okihiro's specialties are in rural crime and higher education, but he did receive a grant from the Japanese Canadian Redress Foundation that allowed him to do a study of the long-term impact of internment on the adaptation economically and socially of Japanese Americans who were interned. He was born in Canada and is a Canadian citizen, but his family has roots here in the United States, even as close as I understand Trinidad, Colorado. And although he may not be open to it, maybe he will share some of that with us. But let me turn it over to Professor Okihiro.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know which way to turn here, right or left. At any rate, is this good enough for recording? One in front of me. Okay, then I can't read, but fine. First of all, I want to say that my name is Norman R. Okihiro, not to be mixed up with Gary Y. Okihiro, who of course is the probably one of the foremost historians and so on. So actually, I haven't even met him. So I just want to make sure a couple of people asked me that. I haven't changed my name. Yeah, I haven't changed anything else, although I understand Trinidad, Colorado is a sex change capital of North America. I haven't changed anything else. I just got back from Trinidad. It's only lately, I've been interested since the redress movement and so on in sort of Japanese Canadians. But I have to say that my father has always been interested, and he was a longtime member of many Japanese various groupings in Toronto. And actually that worked out quite well for me because when I did get funding from the Japanese Canadian Redress Foundation as part of their settlement with Japanese Canadians, I got some money to interview, and I interviewed 100 Japanese Canadians in 1994, mostly in Ontario because I asked for more money, but they didn't give it to me to go out west. But at any rate, that's my sort of background in this area. It turned out that shortly after that, my wife, who is a Hakujin from Newfoundland, the fishery in Newfoundland in 1992, as you know, went bad. The ground fish stocks collapsed. So I then did a study of basically problems in Old Port, Newfoundland. So, but I'm coming back now to this Japanese Canadian business. And so anyhow, that's my background. My approach has been a little different from the historians. What I want to talk about more are sort of general patterns or the context, because there are really, I think, significant differences between what happened to Japanese Canadians during World War II and before, and what happened afterward. And I think in order to understand what happened during the war and after, you have to understand a little bit about what happened to Japanese Canadians prior to the war. So I'm just going to touch on a few points. Almost all the Japanese Canadians who the Japanese came into Canada obviously came into British Columbia. Now, British Columbia is different from Hawaii. It doesn't have a plantation, or it didn't have a plantation economy, or a lot of farming like California. There was mining. It's basically what Harold Innes calls a staples economy. Forests, forestry. So a lot of people ended up working in lumber sawmill camps. They have huge cedar resources there, so shingle camps, that sort of thing. Mining was also an era, particularly coal mining and so on Vancouver Island. So a lot of the early Japanese who came over were contract laborers who worked in those sorts of places. And the other thing I think is in terms of Japanese migration to British Columbia, different from coastal North America, continental North America, was that there was a huge, mostly salmon, but fishery resource on the Fraser River. There still is an important salmon fishery. And in fact, a significant portion of the early migrants to British Columbia came from Wakayama Prefecture. Like most of the rest of people whose ancestors here, most came from Hiroshima or the certain southern prefectures. But in Canada, there was also significant migration from Wakayama, particularly one village called Meal, sometimes called America Village, because an individual had found that there were significant salmon resources, and a large number of people followed from there. So the other thing that I have to mention is we're not talking about the United States. When I listen, when I read these books on the United States, a lot of the issues have to do with constitutional rights being challenged. In fact, I sometimes think Gordon Hirabayashi, of course, the person who brought the lawsuit about the curfew in Seattle, he actually became a sociologist teaching at the University of Alberta. You know, Gordon Hirabayashi is, the University of Alberta is one of these, they had a lot of money when they hired Gordon Hirabayashi, put it that way. But at the same time, we lost S.I. Hayakawa, who later turned into the president of the University of California. So once more, I think, you know, actually when I think of the history of British Columbia, you know, the Alaska Purchase and so on, the defining the boundary of the 49th parallel, in a lot of ways as a Canadian, more Canadian than American, you feel sort of ripped off. But the important thing, what I want to talk about was a little bit about the context. We're talking about British Columbia. So those of you who have been to Victoria and so on know that it's more British than Britain and so on. And the way British Columbia was set up as a British colony, and its population was only about 450 in 1854. And then they discovered gold. And then the Americans came up. The Republicans, people who had a constitution, they came up. And there was an influx of about 25,000. And after the gold rush, about 8,000 remained. But along with them came a significant number of Chinese. And so the first initiation of the British Columbia government with Orientals was with the Chinese. And then, of course, a few years later, British Columbia decided to join Confederation, only with the promise of the building of a railroad from the rest of Canada to connect Vancouver and Victoria and so on. And that was really important because there were, in a period of about 3 years, about 15,000 Chinese laborers. In fact, the rumor is there was a Chinese laborer killed for every, is it kilometer or mile, of the building of the Canadian Pacific Railway. And that's really important because subsequent to that, after after the building of the railroad, there was a lot of unemployment, sporadic unemployment in the resource-based economy in British Columbia. And whenever the local white or native laborers couldn't find jobs, then there was a problem with the non-white laborers, especially the Chinese. And then when the Japanese came in a little bit later, the Japanese were mixed up and not mixed up, but they were basically put in the same category as the Chinese. I say that only partially because from the period from 1894 to about 1921, the local British labor interests were radically anti-Oriental, including anti-Japanese. So when the Japanese did come into the fishing industry and mining and forestry and so on, there were all kinds of attempts by the British Columbia provincial government to do something about it. There were attempts, for example, they put a head tax on the Chinese that went from $50 to, in 1904, 1905, something like that, to $500 a head. $500 a head in, you know, at the turn of the century was a lot of money, obviously. They basically did anything they could to restrict Chinese immigration. I think it's because China obviously had a very weak central government, unlike Japan. And Japanese Canadians were protected by the fact that from 1894 there was a treaty of commerce and navigation between Britain and Japan. So Japan was this rising power. Basically, I think Britain's interest was to keep the ambitions of Russia in check. And you'll recall that in 1904 there was the Russo-Japanese War, which Japan won. So the British, starting in 1894 and in 1902 there was the Anglo-Japanese Alliance, had arranged so that citizens of each other's countries would basically be given the same rights as their own citizens, more or less. And the thing was, Canada is not Britain, but the federal government in Ottawa basically normally supported the view and rejected any policies put forward by the British Columbia government to put the sort of restrictions on the Japanese migrants in the same way that they were put on in the way that they were put on Chinese Canadians. And I think this was probably true all the way through 1921 when that alliance ended and there was another treaty that came into effect. So the treatment of Japanese Canadians was, in my view, allayed by the Anglo-Japanese Alliance. And so what it meant was if the Canadian government wanted to do something, for example, there was an attempt to stop them, Japanese, from becoming naturalized. But it was allowed. The British Columbia labor interests and so on, and the British Columbia government tried to introduce this, but it was blocked by the federal government. So, in a way, prior to 1921, I think Japanese Canadians or the people from Japan who had come to Canada were probably treated better than they were on the west coast of the United States. But this changes. This changes really quickly. And an indication, in my view, of how racist British Columbia, and I emphasize British Columbia was its treatment, for example, of the Chinese, which I've already alluded to. Chinese immigration in Canada, of course, was completely stopped by the 1923 Chinese Exclusion Act. But another good case would be the case of Sikhs. So the people who came from India, actually, the first ones came around 1904, a little bit later than the Japanese. But they came, they were mostly Sikhs, primarily because the Sikhs, you know, these are the ones who wear the turbans and so on. The Sikhs importantly supported the British Army in the sepoy mutiny. And so a lot of them then went into the British Army. Some of them were stationed in Hong Kong. They came to celebrate Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1902. They came across Canada because the CPR had been built at that time, and somebody noted the fishing resources. And a couple of years later, Sikhs started to migrate, mostly to become fishermen and so on. But significant number of Sikhs came by boat, And what happened there was the British Columbia government was not very happy with it. The federal government did not oppose British Columbia's attempt, and in fact endorsed the attempts to stop this migration by coming up with this rule called a continuous voyage rule. So the Sikhs coming from India had to come by way of a direct voyage from India to Canada, whereas most of the ships were stopping in places like Hong Kong or Japan on the way, or even Hawaii on the way over here. The only boats really that were visiting in Canada at the time were Canadian Pacific boats, and of course the government controlled them anyhow. So at any rate, it was a rule that nominally was not targeted against the Sikhs, but officially, unofficially, obviously it was. So the British Columbia government stopped effective migration from the Chinese pretty well. They did a pretty good job against the Sikhs, who were, after all, from another country that was a member of the British Empire. And of course, they had special rights as being in Canada, and or in Britain anyhow, as being members of the British Empire. So the Japanese, I think the racism was attenuated by the fact that there was this Anglo-Japanese alliance. Not to say that local British Columbia people weren't happy with the situation. When a lot of people from Japan, people from Hawaii as well, and some people from the United States migrated to Vancouver in 1907. In fact, there was a boat that carried over 1,200. I think unemployment was relatively high at the time. And to see this this influx of a lot of Japanese resulted in, it was one of the causes of the Vancouver riots of 1907. And Japanese Canadians are sort of happy to say that, well, this mob got unruly, they were egged on by politicians, they went to Chinatown and smashed windows and so on. By the time they got to a little Tokyo, which was right beside Chinatown, they were effectively repulsed. And so Japanese Canadians take some sort of pride in the fact that they chased these people out. And talking to some people, they said after that they took a lot of kendo lessons and so on in Little Tokyo. Okay, I better speed it up a little bit here. From 1921 onward, without the protection of the Anglo-Japanese alliance, I think the racist orientation of the situation in British Columbia mostly had to do with white labor conflicting with the interests of Japanese or non-white labor. The end result was a couple of decades of increasing racial discrimination. For example, in 1911, about half the fishing licenses on the Fraser River were Japanese-Canadian, but they were reduced almost year by year, so that by 1941, only a fraction of the boats were owned by Japanese-Canadians. The end result, they also instituted things like a minimum wage in some of the industries. The minimum wage basically forced some of the Japanese out because the Japanese were paid on average something like about 60% of the wages of white workers. By instituting a minimum wage, of course, then the Japanese were more or less frozen. And a lot of them went into market gardening, strawberry. They opened up the lower Fraser to intensive agriculture. So that's pretty well the situation until World War II. When Pearl Harbor hit, of course, Japanese Canadians were strongly affected as well. But I want to make one important point. Walter Fox is a criminal lawyer from Toronto, who in one of his presentations that I listened to made the point that Canada is a monarchy. You people talk about constitutional rights. You have an American constitution. We don't have any such thing in Canada. Until 1982, when we repatriated, if you like, we had, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is sort of like an American-based document. Basically, there were no civil rights, not even the Diefenbaker Bill of Rights in 1959 or 1957. Basically, was a piece of legislation that could be voted out in the next legislature. So In Canada, we didn't have civil rights. And so, for example, they passed the 1927, could have been earlier, but I think it was 1927, they passed the War Measures Act. That was the same act that was used in World War II, same act that was used in Montreal in 1971 when they had the FLQ threat, you know, this government was going to take over from the established government. Pierre Elliott Trudeau, our famed prime minister, invoked the War Measures Act. But basically, we don't have the same constitutional rights in Canada as in the United States. What we have are probably what Walter Fox calls privileges. They're, because of the favor of the crown. So the treatment of Japanese Canadians, I think you have to keep in mind, was done largely by orders in council given by the cabinet, by the federal cabinet. And they were largely influenced, I think, by the unfettered British Columbia politicians. Probably the best book on the background of this by an historian would be Ann Gomer Sunaharra's The Politics of Racism. But I'm not going to get into all the details of the court case. Why? We didn't have any court cases. You know, you have your Gordon Hirabayashis and so on. In Canada, basically, there was nobody opposing any of the orders in council that took place. And there were orders in council that, first of all, there was a fishing fleet of about 1,100 fishing boats. Shortly after December 7th, they were all impounded. They were taken away. They were floated down the Fraser River to New Westminster. I talked to people who had boats, and they said they didn't care. They just banged them all together. Some people took their own boats because they didn't want them banged together. And then shortly thereafter, they were sold without the permission of the owners. Similarly, any property that you didn't take with you when you were interned it was administered by the custodian of alien property, and they had pretty well arbitrary powers. There were some farms, mostly in the lower mainland, and these were taken away and sold without owner's permission. So the rule was probably similar to the rule in continental, the west coast of the U.S. Basically, by January the 14th, anybody within a 100-mile limit of the west coast of British Columbia, which was practically all of them, basically you had to sign a registration card. That was even before the war. And then eventually they were all to be moved out of that area. It was supposed to be a partial evacuation at first, but the British Columbia, I would say, racist political politicians, people who had something to gain, were basically unopposed. And eventually it was anybody who was of Japanese origin was in the same boat. It didn't matter. So if, in the United States, for example, I'm not sure that it's 100%, but if you're born in the United States, you get American citizenship rights. In Canada, Japanese Canadian, like my father was, or my mother was born in Vancouver. They had rights of naturalization, but if one of the important rights is the right to vote, Japanese Canadians did not get the right to vote. It was larger, and this was verified by a 1902 Privy Council. In Canada, the ultimate authority back then was a Privy Council of Britain. So if there was a challenge, it eventually went to the Privy Council in Britain, and they supported the idea. They didn't exactly discriminate directly against Japanese Canadians. What they said was they let go the idea that if a person, in order to vote in a federal election in Canada, you had to be on the provincial voters list, and they said it was okay. That rule was okay. The province of British Columbia did not allow any Japanese Canadians on the provincial voters list. If you weren't on the provincial voters list or the federal list, it also meant that you couldn't become a pharmacist, a lawyer, couldn't get a hand logger's license, you couldn't work in various branches of the civil servant. But it was a way of sort of getting around the idea that it was directly against Japanese Canadians. But it probably was the way that rule went. So at any rate, during the war, I'll try to finish up here fairly quickly. They impounded the fleet. They took away the boats. Some people got very little notice. My Aunt Betty, for example, lived in near Campbell River, a little fishing community. Said the RCMP came in, and she said she had a turkey dinner in the oven, and she had 24 hours to take her stuff out. And so the people in the coastal communities were the first to be moved out. One of the principles of what happened on the West Coast was that they didn't want to split up families. In Canada, there was some discussion over the whole thing, but they eventually ended up splitting up families, where most of the males went to work in road camps, and their wives and families were sometimes put in separate internment camps. There were some exceptions. If you were willing to work on a sugar beet farm in some place like Alberta, or maybe even in Manitoba on some sort of farm there, some families who were really bent on being intact went there, which is not, in my view, a really good alternative. Sugar beet work, I understand, is, I don't know, like picking tobacco, really back-breaking work, and so on. Unlike the Americans as well, Canadians had to pay for their own incarceration. So if you were put, for example, in one of those road camps, and you had a family, you had to pay, I think you got about $50 a month, and they took $22.50 out for the support of your family. Or no, $20 out for the support of your family, and $22.50 for your own room and board. So basically, you had to pay for your own incarceration. There were self-supporting camps as well for people who had their own money and who were willing to move outside of the 100-mile limit. Another huge difference was that Canadians, by and large, were not allowed to join the war effort. There were more veterans of World War I of Japanese origin than World War II. There were attempts by some Japanese to enlist, and a few people who enlisted prior to Pearl Harbor were allowed, to join the military. They did have a call, and you were subject, even though you didn't have voting privileges, you were subject to a medical test, but they didn't then accept any people of Japanese Canadian origin, even if you were born in Canada. And that was largely, I think, because of British Columbia politicians and other interest groups feeling that what would happen is if you allow these people to fight for the country, that's a pretty good ground for giving them the vote. And they didn't want to give them the vote. And so there were less than 200 people who actually served Japanese Canadians or the Japanese in Canada who served in World War II. And they were only allowed to serve toward the end of the war when the British Army came in, and they were looking for people who could interpret. And they were going to take 10 or 12 of these people, and then the Canadian government probably felt a little bit embarrassed and then allowed them to enter the Canadian military. The list, it's sort of interesting. There's a book here, We Went to War, by Roy Ito. He's one of these people in World War II. He has a few pages at the end listing the names of all the Canadians who served in World War I and World War II. By the way, even if you served in World War I, you were not allowed to vote until 1931. So veterans of World War I, one quarter of whom died in battle, for the remainder, only a few people who were around in 1931 were actually allowed to vote. So this is a horror story. The internment for Japanese Canadians lasted a lot longer, partly because of American Supreme Court decisions. You guys have constitutional rights. In Canada, we don't. At least we didn't. In December 1744, just before a Supreme Court decision that the government felt was going to be not favorable to the U.S., it rescinded the exclusion order. And the idea was within 1 year, everybody would be out of the camps. In January 1946, there were still 9,658 people in internment camps. In 1947, 2 years after the war, there were still 900. And it was 1948 before the last people, so most of them were probably infirm and so on, who were out of the camps. Probably to add insult to injury, in the United States, it's still the case, for example, that probably 50% of Japanese Americans live within 100 miles of Los Angeles. In Canada, it's completely different because all Japanese aliens, including those born in Canada, were required to, in August of 1944, either indicate your loyalty to Canada by agreeing to move east of the Rocky Mountains or be deported to Japan. In the camps where they took the votes, the vast majority haven't been treated so badly, elected to go back to Japan. However, the Canadian government after the war allowed some people to recant. But it was the case that about 4,000 Japanese Canadians, including, I think, not sure if it was a majority, I have the figures here somewhere, people who were born in Canada who had never been to Japan were sent back to a war ravaged Japan. And I talked to a couple of these people, and some of them said it was awful. You know, one person said, if we didn't eat so little, we were used to eating little, right? We would have starved to death, and so on. So there was a relocation and dispersal. So you had to move east of the Rockies. Most of the people had agricultural jobs, but eventually they ended up in cities and so on. But now if you take a look at the distribution of Japanese Canadians, it's much different from the United States. The big draw, I guess, would be Toronto and Ontario, which is a lot different from what it is in the United States. As well as in places like Toronto, it wasn't the case that you could move wherever you wanted. They didn't want people to start another little Tokyo like they had in British Columbia before the war. So I actually did a study for the Toronto Buddhist Church in the 1990s, and I found that there was an even distribution of Japanese Canadians all across Toronto, because what they wanted to do was they wanted to locate their church where closest to where most people could go. And I couldn't give them a recommendation because they were dispersed all over the place. Finally, the Japanese Canadians were not allowed to return to within 100 miles of the Pacific Ocean until 1949. And were not given the franchise either till 1949. So that by the time redress hit Canada, at about the same time as the U.S., as a result of the American, I think, movement in 1988, the Canadian government agreed to pay $21,000 to each Japanese Canadian. It was $1,000 more in sort of nominal terms. But the Canadian dollar at that time was really low. We got ripped off. Yeah, you know. And it was $21,000, I think, an implicit recognition of the idea that compared to Japanese Americans, Japanese Canadians, I think, were more severely affected by the war. So that's those are the highlights that I want to talk about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Okihiro. You've been very enlightening about the differences between the Canadian and Jap and the American cases. While I was listening to your presentation, I, as a political scientist, decided I will make my pitch. We in America tend to talk about democracy in a very general way, but as you listened, you can see that democracy ought to be called United States democracy, Canadian democracy, German democracy, Japanese democracy is not the same wherever you happen to be. So that's my pitch as a political scientist. Before I open it up to the audience, let me apologize. I, as a moderator, am supposed to repeat each question so that it will be put onto the mic and recorded. But I apologize for being, you know, hard of hearing. So I've asked the panelists if they would repeat the question before they answer it. So I will call on the people, but the panelists will repeat your question. But maybe we have a prior.
When I was in Hawaii, administrations in general or parties? Are there traits of parties or just traits of administrations in general?
The question is that since the actions in Hawaii were done under a Democratic administration and the current actions are done under a Republican administration, is it a question of parties or is it a question of national acts? I think that the lesson of the Japanese-American experience is that you can't trust anybody. I mean, we have Earl Warren. We have Franklin Roosevelt, as great a humanitarian as ever has sat in the White House. We have Hugo Black, one of the most extraordinary Supreme Court justices in favor of civil rights. If you can't trust those people to defend human rights, we shouldn't just beat up on George Bush and John Ashcroft and all the rest. It shows that all of these things, whatever your constitutional rights, are pieces of paper as long as there is mass public outcry and dangers to national security to justify people's extreme actions. And so we have to take the lesson as citizens that it is our responsibility to stand up and to defend and to tell our stories in order to remind people that what happens when we don't respect civil liberties.
And I, as a political scientist, second that heartily. I think the second hand I saw was...
Yes.
Okay. I have three...
The question is, what is the book referred to about Canadian Japanese?
If you want one... I was going to have a handout or something like that, but I didn't have time. The best single volume, in my view, was actually not written by a sociologist or an historian. It was written by a journalist. The Enemy That Never Was by Ken Adachi. So in 1976, it's probably still, I think, the most comprehensive history of Japanese Canadians. If you're interested in World War II political events, The Politics of Racism by Ann Gomer Sunahara. And if you're particularly interested in the input to the military, probably Roy Ito wrote a book called We Went to War. And so those would be the three. I would strongly recommend, if you're interested in the social and economic adaptation of Japanese Canadians, that you purchase at a nominal cost my own small unpublished report on... of the Nisei and the Sansei.
If we're plugging our works, next spring Columbia University Press will come out with my book tentatively entitled Manzanar and Beyond, which is a transnational history of Japanese ethnic removal and confinement, which talks about the United States and Canada and Mexico, the Japanese Mexicans who were removed, the Japanese Latin Americans, and the effects of martial law on Japanese Americans in Hawaii.
I have no book to promote, but I think having heard their presentations, you'll all be interested in purchasing a copy of their publications. I think I saw the hand back there first.
The question is, when World War II was over, why did the Canadian government expatriate Japanese Canadians, even those born in Canada? The answer is quite simple, British Columbia. British Columbia didn't want them back. Thus, the Canadian government had confiscated people's belongings and sold them off. Thus, the Canadian government had pressured them to move east and had lured them into signing requests for expatriation. And thus the Canadian government kept them from voting. I should differ with my colleague that there was an important court case challenging the mass involuntary deportation of Japanese Canadians that was brought by the Coordinating Council for Japanese Canadians and the Japanese Canadian Citizens for Democracy. And in the Canadian Supreme Court, which ruled for the government in a split motion that the government had the right to deport Japanese male citizens involuntarily, but split over the question of whether they could legally deport Japanese Canadian citizens or Japanese citizens who were women. and that the Privy Council of in London later confirmed that. But by that time, the Japanese Canadian citizens and the non-Japanese sympathizers had changed the political atmosphere in British Columbia and elsewhere so much that the government was forced to abandon its quest to deport people. Although by that time, as my colleague says, Professor Okiro says, 4,000 people, either voluntarily or involuntarily, had been sent away.
Okay, I was going to go to this side since.
Okay.
Okay, the question was, could you give an idea of the numbers involved? I actually have a table here, but in general, about 22,000 Japanese Canadians were affected by the policy to move east of the they were interned or sent somewhere other within a 100-mile limit. There are about, I think, about 1,500 or so Japanese Canadians who are living outside of the 100-mile limit, but they're practically all in, you know, Japanese concentrated areas like New Westminster, Little Tokyo, parts of Vancouver, and so on. So I would guess about 95% of the Japanese Canadians were affected by the orders.
It should be remembered that this makes a big difference because there was no Hawaii for Japanese Canadians. That is, there was no large population that was not rounded up and could prove its loyalty by efforts. And as a result, the Japanese Canadians were subjected to far greater suspicion. The question is how, if there's censorship of and bans on opposition to government or military policies, what's the most effective way to protest? I should say that it's only within Hawaii that martial law dictated censorship of newspapers. People could still and did publish outside of Hawaii questions relating to martial law, either supporting it or sometimes opposing it. Garner Anthony, again, had published that article in the California Law Review, and there were other articles in the mainstream press on the continental United States about Hawaii. But it is a very difficult problem. Part of the way that the army and the government shield themselves from responsibility for repressive policies is by excluding media and keeping the glare of public attention off of them. Probably the best other solution, other than trying to use the Freedom of Information Act, trying to use such information as you can get, or smuggling it out, is to make sure that you elect people who have some knowledge of this. The way that we avoided racial profiling on airlines is primarily because the Secretary of Transportation after 9/11 was Norman Mineta, who had been confined in the Heart Mountain camp as a kid.
Is there any research that this department has done?
The question is, why were the Hawaiian men who were sent to Santa Fe or to Jerome and to the other WRA camps or Justice Department internment camps rounded up? I think that there is an enormous need that we saw after 9/11 to seem to be doing something when in times of trouble. And the Japanese Americans in Hawaii, like on the mainland, the Japanese aliens were subjected to this arrest based on their place on what were called the ABC lists. That is, they were rounded up not because of their opinions, but because, or any individual suspicion against them, but because of their place in the community, because they were Japanese school teachers, or they were connected with the consulate, or they were considered potentially dangerous based on guilt by association. The question is, what about the Korematsu case? Does it still stand as precedent? What I said was that the Duncan case, the martial law cases in Hawaii, went against the logic of Korematsu, and thus Eugene Rostow, the professor at Yale, who was the chief critic of Korematsu, said that these cases had eviscerated the logic of Korematsu, and so the Supreme Court should have quite simply reversed Korematsu, that it was a failure of the court not to live up to its real logic. In fact, Professor Sunishi is quite right that the Korematsu case is still good law, and it stands over us, as Robert Jackson predicted, like a loaded gun, a loaded weapon. And it has been invoked by the government in cases after 9/11 in the service of arbitrary repression. The question is whether there were any acts of resistance other than the habeas corpus that took place to martial law. It's a very good question, and I don't have evidence of any organized protests against martial law. And again, the Japanese Americans in Hawaii seem to have been particularly cowed. See, I mean, I don't want to make a value judgment, because if I was faced with that kind of threat under military occupation to my liberties, I don't know if I would have the courage to make a protest, particularly when the President of the United States had said that martial law and revocation of habeas corpus were both justified measures. I know that there were various people who wrote to the mainland, to either to newspapers or to others, just to friends, to talk about the hardships of martial law. But I'm not familiar with any organized protest within Hawaii, which would have been very dangerous to the people who protested, I think.
May I just speak to that to a certain degree? I think, and Professor Robinson has referred to it, that organized efforts by Japanese, American, and Hawaii were so strongly to show their loyalty to the United States that resistance, even if it, you know, it was available in a minor way, was overshadowed by the efforts to show their loyalty.
follow-up question.
And follow?
In light of today, the Bush administration's efforts actually preceded by Clinton's efforts to cut habeas corpus, was there any effort to even cut off the ability of people to, was there any effort to suspend habeas corpus?
The question is, in light of today's evisceration of habeas corpus, whether there was any attempt to cut off habeas corpus. Well, yes, of course, that's what the military did. They eliminated habeas corpus, and they provided for arbitrary confinement of people, and that's what happened to Sanjiabe, for example. The difference, and then when Judge Metzger, the federal judge, interpreted the Army's reestablishment of civilian rule as reestablishing habeas corpus, the Army and the Justice Department challenged this. And as I said, General Richardson went so far as to refuse to produce the two people who were being confined, Seifert and Glockner, who had presented habeas corpus petitions, and to rough up Judge Metzger's officials when they came to serve the writs. And he threatened Judge Metzger that if Judge Metzger pursued habeas corpus hearings on this, that he would send him away for 5 years at hard labor. So this is not exactly an administration that is looking with benevolence on habeas corpus provisions. President Roosevelt himself was ready to remove habeas corpus after the Hirabayashi case. He was warned by one of his advisors that the Supreme Court was likely to overturn Hirabayashi as concerned in the Executive Order 9066 as concerned American citizens. And he said that we will have a limited local martial law in that case, whatever we can make stick.
Well, we're close to the end of our time in any case. And if there are no further questions, may I thank the audience for your attention and participation. And would you wish our panelists a thank you for their efforts? And thank